This next conversation comes from our live event that we recently taped in downtown Traverse City. While up north, we took the opportunity to invite the most well-traveled resident of Sutton's Bay to join us to talk about his travels, specifically his space travels. Jerry Lininger was the first American to conduct a spacewalk from a foreign space station and in a non-American spacesuit. We spoke at the Inside Out Gallery the evening of September 17th, and here's our conversation. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we are here in Traverse City, Michigan. Well, let's say you're a kid from Metro Detroit, because this story will prove the moments that send you on your life's pathway can come at any age. You're camping in Ontario with your family. It's July 20th, 1969, watching in that little TV as Neil Armstrong becomes the first man to set foot on the moon, and you decide, I want to go into space. And so you grow up to become an astronaut. You go into space on the shuttles Discovery and Atlantis, and you spend 5 months on the Russian space station Mir. You ultimately rack up 143 days and 52 minutes in space. Over 2,177 orbits of the Earth, you fly 54.5 million miles in space. You do all that, and then you come home to Michigan, and you settle down in Sutton's Bay. That's what retired Navy captain and astronaut Dr. Jerry Lininger has done, and he is here with us tonight on Stateside. Dr. Jerry Lininger, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be on the planet here in Traverse City.
You know, I stopped and I was checking my calendar, and as we talk right now, on this day, 22 years ago tonight, in 1994, you were aboard the Discovery on your first space flight.
And half of Michigan was there because it was a winter launch, so everybody got out of Detroit and came down to Florida.
Yeah, I have to ask you, Jerry, you know, there are so few people that have experienced what you have and being launched into orbit. I've got to ask you, tell us, what is it like, especially those moments just before liftoff and then off you go?
You know, it's just awesome. It's just power like you've never felt before and just rumbles in your gut. You're lying on your back for about 2 hours. They do the last checks, verifications of the engines. I'm thinking about actually you, Cynthia, and I'm thinking everybody here. I'm saying I'm representing mankind, and I'm going to do it right. Thinking about my teammates up there, not going to let them down, the rest of the crew, not going to let my United States Navy down, my organization, going to make people proud. And then it's just this rumble, and you get shot back into your seat, and it is chaotic. You're being thrown around back and forth as the guidance tries to keep you within a certain envelope. You get thrown back and forth. You're being jostled around. 2 minutes into the flight, boom, boom, big explosion. Solid rocket boosters literally explode off, and now the ride goes from utter chaos to pure acceleration. You're thrown back into your seat. You feel those 3 Gs as they continue to build. Do that for about the last 6 minutes. Engines cut off. Bodies fly away. Your own body flies away as you become weightless, and, you know, it's yahoo, I'm in space, and I made it, yeah.
You took us along, Jerry. That was
great.
Yeah, good.
It's awesome. I mean, I wish I could snap my fingers and get us. Maybe you don't want to take that ride, trust me. It's a wild ride, but I wish I could snap my fingers, get everyone up in space, look down at the planet, get a different perspective, the big picture, think strategically, realize we're all in it together, and a lot of the problems would just dissolve away.
You know, it must have been something that, especially that first time when you could look down and see the mitten. I mean, our state really stands out, you know. What do you think?
Well, I'll go beyond the first time. When I went with my two Russian crewmates, they speak no English, and I kept teaching them. The only word they knew was Michigan. And so when we go over the top of Michigan, sometimes they'd come over and grab me, Jerry, Michigan, Michigan, and they do the hand thing and show me the mitten. Because it definitely looks like God's left hand has blessed our state, and it's a beautiful spot of the world right here.
You know, that assignment that you said, all right, I'll go do this, you had to learn Russian. Then you went to Russia and trained in Star City to be a cosmonaut. You were there with Russians, our former Cold War enemies. All those months on Mir, do you still remember Russian?
Da, ya govorit mnogo по-русски. I remember speaking Russian. I'm a little rusty, but I can do okay. I can hold my own. New York City cab drivers, I can usually communicate pretty well, get my way around. But yeah, it was quite an immersion. I had about 2 years in Russia. I was basically trained an astronaut as a cosmonaut. Everything was in Russian. every morning, one-on-one, language teacher speaking in Russian only, spoke no English. Every afternoon, a rocket scientist talking about electrical circuit diagrams in Russian. And thank God for, you know, universal language of engineering, because over his shoulder, there's a flip chart, and I just started memorizing electric circuit diagrams.
Amazing.
And flip the chart over every day. But, you know, you're up in space, two guys that speak no English, broken communication system, basically could not talk to Earth, only talked to Moscow when we could talk to Earth. And so it was isolation, cut off, you know, stuck with myself more than I've ever been in my life. And I'm an old Navy guy. I've been on aircraft carriers and submarines. But I'll tell you, that's just a removal from mankind, and you better be comfortable with who you are as a person, because you will find out what you're made out of, what you can withstand, and how you can hold up.
Your book, Off the Planet, Surviving Five Perilous Months Aboard the Space Station Mir, you write about Mir, and you and I have talked about this. It's not exactly our Star Trek image of the sleek, futuristic spacecraft. And you talked about the smell of the space station and the look of the space station.
Yeah, you know, it was their design life of 3 to 5 years. It was about 10, 12 years old by the time I got there. And they had no means before the shuttle came of getting stuff off of it. So it would just keep building up stuff and more stuff. And you fly into some of the modules, it's like flying through or scuba diving through a kelp bed. You're literally pushing things aside. There's no way you can use that module. It's just basically a garbage dump. And when you open the hatch to the Mir, it smelled as if you're going into grandma's basement with the old musty smell. And he said, okay, this is a little different. And reversing that, when the shuttle came to pick me up after 5 months, you get aboard the shuttle, it's just clean and sterile and smells nice, and they even have dehydrated shrimp cocktail. So enough of that dehydrated borscht and sucking jellied fish out of toothpaste for 5 months.
I want to get a little serious. Talk to us about the fire.
Mm-hmm. We had what was described as the most severe fire ever on an orbiting spacecraft, big-time flame. Oxygen generator, which had built-in fuel, built-in oxygen, got sparking, and we had about a 3 or 4 foot in length blowtorch-like fire with smoke just billowing out. Couldn't see the five fingers in front of your face within about 30 seconds of that fire starting. Exhausted 4 fire extinguishers before we finally pretty much just contained secondary fires. And the original fire melted itself, ate up all the chemical, melted a big refrigerator-sized metallic canister behind it, pretty much down to nothing from the heat blast. And, of course, the whole time you're just saying, you know, I hope this respirator keeps working, number one. Number two, I hope that blowtorch doesn't point down, because if it pierces that hull, it's made out of aluminum, you know, a quarter inch thick, not even that. You got rapid decompression, quick suffocation. And so during that time, you know, your training better kick in. You better have competent crewmates. And, you know, I just screamed out, we're going to get that fire out. I was actually thinking about my family. You met my family, mm-hmm, Cynthia.
Yeah.
I said, I'm going to see my boy again. I'm going to do everything right. And you get very methodical, and your training kicks in, and you try to keep your cool. Now, that night after the thing's all done, then you let your heart beat, then you catch up and say, man, I was lucky to get out of that one by the skin
here
of my teeth.
Well, yeah. What's been done? Has anything been able to be done to protect our crews from fire? And
you know, we're still looking at that. Yeah. The Apollo fire, a lot of people might remember, you know, Grissom's crew we lost on Apollo 1967. Mm-hmm. And then in my fire, worst fire ever on an orbiting spacecraft, we survived, but I'll tell you, it was by the skin of our teeth. Then more recently, I just got a call and did some different interviews on things. There's a Sapphire experiment that's being done now on the International Space Station. When they talked to the lead investigator, he said during Jerry Leninger's fire, you know, they got by the skin of their teeth, and we're still looking at this problem. So now on International Space Station, when a resupply ship unloads everything, you fill that with the garbage I was talking about, mm-hmm, that you accumulate. You stuff it with whatever you want, because it's going to come back, re-enter the atmosphere, and burn up. And so instead of just stuffing it with garbage, we put this Sapphire experiment. Sort of looks like we're just talking about the urns, but it kind of, mm-hmm, looks like a small short man coffin. It's about 3 foot by 3 foot by 5 foot. And inside there, you have high-speed cameras, sensors, and we are starting fires in this returning spacecraft, the largest man-made fire ever on a spacecraft. and we study the characteristics of it. Spaceflight is really a controlled risk business. When you fundamentally get down to it, you look at any risk you can control, and you do your best to minimize that risk. If I'm doing a spacewalk and a micrometeorite hits me, you know, I'm gone. I just say, okay, nothing I can do about that. You tuck that one away, it doesn't bother you at all. If my suit gets a puncture doing a spacewalk, I better know what to do. I better know how to go to emergency oxygen. I better know a path back to get in the airlock, and I better do the procedures correctly. Same thing with a fire. You better be methodical about how you do it, but we better understand the nature of fire in space better so that we can save crews in the future.
That five-hour spacewalk, you're the first American to conduct a spacewalk at a foreign space station. There you were out there for 5 hours. Awesome.
It's awesome. You know, you're a self-contained spacecraft. We open that hatch. I've got a couple tethers about 4 foot in length. And you're just like a mountainside climber on the edge of a cliff. You're responsible for keeping yourself attached. You know, if you become detached with any kind of motion, matter in motion stays in motion. I'd still be up there 100 years from now, 300 years from now, fireball through the sky. So you keep yourself attached. Had a big 500-pound sensor package I had to install way out on the end of a module. So I attached myself and it to a telescoping pole. Vasily got at the base of the pole, swung me out about 15 meters away, swung me through space, and I'll tell you, it's like a fish on a fly rod on the Boardman River. You're just dangling out there, you know, stars all around you. The one thought I had is how silly we are to think that we can actually name the universe. There are just so many stars out there. You know, good luck picking out the Big Dipper. And you're out there by yourself on the dark side of the Earth. I'm dangling out there, so we're not inside the payload bay of the shuttle. You can't light it. And so for that 45 minutes on the dark side of the Earth, I just dangled out there and looked at the heavens, and I'll tell you, it's spectacular.
I'm wondering about your thoughts about where our space program is now. We've got U.S. astronauts having to rely on renting space and Russian spacecraft or spacecraft flown by the private sector. Was killing the Constellation, the Lunar Exploration Program, or axing the shuttle program, was that a mistake?
I think we made, I wouldn't say the whole thing was a mistake. I think NASA got very methodical, saying we cannot afford to build the next generation, which was an Orion capsule, could go to the moon, could go to Mars, without phasing out the shuttle program. So we had a very well-thought-out program where we'll phase out the shuttle, we'll use that extra funds to just supplement the budget we already have. And then in about a year and a half from then, so that should have been, you know, 6 years ago, we'll have a brand new capsule and we'll get U.S. astronauts back to space again on a U.S.-built capsule. Unfortunately, the budget didn't change, but the administration, the present administration, decided they're going to give it to the private space companies, about half of that budget. And so we're building these private spacecraft, and you know, we just saw what happened with the SpaceX one. I'll tell you, if you saw that film of that thing exploding on launch, I told myself, man, I was maybe luckier than I thought. Because when you see that raw power, it's just incredible how much oomph you have behind you. So anyway, we're doing the private stuff. It's great. I'm all for space tourism, but they just should not be robbing NASA's budget. Mm-hmm. At all astronauts' reunions, I talked to the old Apollo guys, and Alan Bean's talking to Walt Cunningham, and Alan says, seems to me these guys are building something we built, was it 1962, had about that capability, and, you know, Alan Bean, fourth man on the moon, says, yeah, we built an equivalent thing, except we could actually rendezvous and dock. They didn't have to reach out and grab us. So it's a great accomplishment. I'm all for innovation and everything else, but after this experiment of 6 years, we still don't have a spacecraft to put a U.S. astronaut in space, and when they finally gave out the contracts to do that, they gave one to SpaceX. Again, we just had an accident. Mm-hmm. They gave the other one to Boeing. That's a familiar name, you know? And I think if they gave that contract to Boeing, another private space company, but with a lot of experience and a lot of competence, 8 years ago, we'd have a vessel and we could be heading off to the moon or Mars.
Well, and speaking of Mars, final question for a physician astronaut as we move to that goal of sending manned flight to Mars. Are humans made for long-term space flight like that? Did you experience any?
Yeah, I think we are. I'm on the planning for some of that, and it's the way we're planning, it's probably a 2.5-3 year trip, because when you get there, Mars is moving through the universe relative to Earth and relative to the sun. And so there's only certain windows where you can launch off of Mars. So you can get there, stay about 2 or 3 days, and get the heck off of there so that you can get back to Earth with a, amount of thrust that's reasonable. Or you stay on Mars for about a year, and then you're in a good position again a year later. So my vote is you stay on Mars for at least a year. You have a vehicle set up there. We use all the advancements we have now, robotics, all the things we already have on Mars, to pre-position basically a settlement on Mars. Through telemetry, even though it takes, a half hour to get the signal back, you can still check out that, yes, it has oxygen inside that module. Yes, it's holding pressure. Yes, our rover is there. You can even start a little factory on Mars, take the carbon dioxide, bring up some hydrogen, mix it together, make a rocket fuel, and use that to get yourself back, which makes your trip to Mars a lot less complicated, because that's the hard part, is taking a big, heavy vehicle onto the surface of Mars in order to get back. And that's where those discussions of a one-way trip to Mars come in. Would you volunteer for that? And, once my kids are grown, I think I'd volunteer for that.
You would.
With the expectation that when I got there, I would use my Matt Damon sort of Martian brain power to figure out a way to get that factory going, to make that rocket fuel, and hope that in a few years they send me the shell of a rocket, and then I'm able to blast off. And I will say that the SpaceX and Blue Origin, some of those companies that are landing those stages back, if you're found, they're launching a rocket, the first stage falls off, used to plop into the ocean, they're actually controlling that thing, bringing it back, and landing it on a pad. They're not doing that just for cost savings. They talk about that, but let's face it, the shuttle was a renewable vessel also. We could reuse it, but it was still expensive. But it's a good technology on Mars because you might be able to bring a vessel down, land it, and then be able to use that vessel using fuel you make on Mars to get yourself back home again. So that's a technology where they're looking beyond just tomorrow. They're looking, all right, if we go to Mars, we're going to need that technology. Let's start working on it today. Plus, we have benefits today of having a reusable first stage rocket.
Exciting, exciting stuff. Dr. Jerry Lininger, it was such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for all you've done for your country and for being with us tonight.
It's an honor representing the world, really, and our great country in particular, and nice being on your show. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Yeah.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.